everybody. Welcome to Wednesday edition, Bulldog Hour. Kevin Russ alongside here as always until 3. CG will join me around 2:35 for some transition on a Wednesday, and then he will take over for 2 hours, and the Giants will get ready to play the Rocks at 5 o'clock with the pre and 5:40 first pitch from Coors. On 790 tonight, it will be the deciding Game 7 between the Sharks and the Avs from SAP in San Jose. It is a huge sports night in the Bay Area. You know, the last time this sort of thing happened in 2016, both the Warriors and Sharks ended up without the seasons finishing the way they had hoped, and both end up losing things at home. Hopefully tonight the Sharks will move on to play the Blues for the Western Conference final, and also hopefully the Warriors won't make this what could be their last game ever at Oracle. This is a crazy situation for the Warriors. If they lose tonight, if they were to lose this one and then lose Friday Game 6 in Houston, the Warriors would be leaving Oracle without the fan base knowing that tonight was the final game. If the Warriors win tonight, the fan base knows that no matter what, there's either going to be a Game 7 on Sunday at home or they're going to be on to the next round. But there's a possibility if Houston wins tonight that you could actually have the Warriors fan base that was so loyal and still is loyal, but for the last 40-plus years there in Oakland after coming over from San Francisco, they could actually end up with tonight being the final game ever played there, but they wouldn't know it until Friday. So we'll see what happens. And also we want to mention we have Bulldog Baseball coming up over the weekend, very important series. Softball probably on the outside looking in now, maybe that NIT bid for softball is available. And another note, 4 o'clock today, the heptathlon starts the outdoor Mountain West Track and Field Championships at Fresno State. So hope you go out there as well. All right, we want to talk to our good friend Jackson Moore right now, barkboard.com. Jackson, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Tony. How are you?
I'm doing okay, Jackson, except my allergies are driving me out of my mind. Everybody, I think, in this valley who has allergies knows right now is not the greatest time, right? You've got pollen everywhere, and the gentle breezes bring everything to you. So, if we get through this hour, I'll be a pleased guy. If I get through tonight, it'll be a minor miracle. We'll see how that works out. All right, I want to get started with a couple things here. First of all, our good friend Scott down in Tulare had sent in an email, Jackson, actually two of them. The latest of the two he sent in, again, guys, tdad1@att.net, tdad, the number one, @att.net, comes right to me. He said he went through the Fresno State ticket office. We still don't know the time of the USC game, but he went through the ticket office at Fresno State and was told tickets are $100 a pop. His question was, Jackson, if you happen to know, is this USC mandating this? Is this Fresno State's look at this game? What do you know about this?
Yeah, that I'm not 100% sure on. I tried to go through USC's site to see what their individual tickets were going for, and I'm not sure if they've actually got them going for sale yet. A lot of teams, you know, they try to get those season tickets and mini packets out before they go to individual games. And just looking through Ticketmaster, it looks like, you know, just to get into the stadium, probably about $70 on the resale market. So $100 right now might not be, you know, too crazy of a number out of the question. But the way USC's fan base kind of dropped off last year, I wouldn't be surprised if closer to game time, unless they are excited about the new season and come out to the Coliseum, that there'll probably be some empty seats and some maybe more affordable options at that time.
Well, Scott also asked, are these tickets that are way off in the periphery, what have you? The only way you know that is to get information about what the ticket location is and then go to the map for the Coliseum and figure it out. It is, without question, Jackson, a game that SC is aware will draw a number of Fresno State fans, so it's not beyond the realm of possibility they're going to pick up a few extra dollars themselves. But Scott also asked if it might have something to do, if the ticket prices at all are Fresno State's doing, about, as he referred to, the renovation, which is really the upgrade of the stadium. As you know, the renovation is, from a connotative standpoint, it's probably true. From a denotative standpoint, renovation is technically not what's going on right now. It's the upgrades in the facility. So Scott asked about that, and then he also asked about both the lighting and the field turf and my lighting. Sidebar, last night Mike Fiers throws a no-hitter for the A's, and the Coliseum, people that talk about Bulldog Stadium need an upgrade. The Coliseum is falling to pieces. You know, the sewer system keeps backing up. They always are having trouble there. Last night, a lighting problem, which the national media reported as a lightning problem. That's right, in Oakland last night, the lightning strikes were hitting. So it was almost 9 o'clock at night, midnight in Cincinnati, because it was the Reds coming across the country to play. They started at 9 o'clock, body time for Cincy, and they get no hits. So the A's have found the secret, Jackson. Start all their games when the East teams come in at midnight, body time for the Eastern teams, and the A's will roll right through everybody. That's their plan. They should have thought of that when the Yankees came to town to Oracle Park last week. Anyway, about the two issues that Scott brought up, one, because Pat has talked about it on air, any upgrade coming from the lighting at Bulldog Stadium, and also Scott wanted to know, any different look as the new sprint turf, the new field turf comes in?
Yeah, from my understanding, the turf should feature a lot of the same things that the current turf has, which has become pretty much a tradition at this point with the red and white checkerboard in the end zone. Pat Hill brought that, and it's been in those Bulldog Stadium end zones for quite some time now. The green V is going to be prominently featured from what I've heard, and I imagine the Bulldog will be right there in the middle. So the basics will all be there. I imagine there will be some sort of distinction so that you can actually tell that it's a new turf. The current turf is actually held up pretty well, but it's just one of those things. They only last so long, and it's time to switch that one over. With the lighting, I'm not sure how much brighter it'll be, but I do know that they're working on some sort of fixes so that, you know, the light structures don't blow out during a game like which occurred against Hawaii this past season. I'm not sure if performance will be touched, but there should be, as far as keeping the lights on, that's going to be taken care of, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's been a battle, an unfortunate battle in conference, as you know, between Fresno State and San Diego State, who can keep the lights on the longest, right? Because they've had the problem down at the Murph in San Diego, and we know the situation there with an aging stadium. And here, hopefully, they're going to be able to do the mandatory upgrades. Jackson, how far away, though, if you want to talk about the line of delineation between upgrade and renovation, how far out do you think we are from any of the grand plans that Bartko put forth in that PowerPoint, which seems like forever ago, but was actually, what, February of 15, I guess? I mean, how far away are we in all this stuff right now?
Yeah, Tony, I would still see it being quite a few years out. I think what they will try to do as the funds become available is to do some of it in phases. So it won't be 1 year the Bulldog Stadium looks the way it does, and the next year it'll look like that design that was shown to everyone when Bartko presented it. But I think they will try to implement some of those features over the years and perhaps look at some other things that may be more desirable for the program, such as the you know, the staff facilities right now, amongst the Mountain West, the coaching staff offices and the locker room area is not the most luxurious by any means. So there has been talks of potentially building a different facility on the south end of the stadium and kind of roping it around and maybe focusing more on something like that rather than what we saw before with the big brand new press box and suites and all those kinds of things.
This year's schedule, you and I talked about it last week. Do you view the Minnesota game as the only big marquee game? It's difficult to know the context in conference because it depends upon how things go. But just the order that you and I talked about last week, does that appear to be that one circled date, or does Minnesota not carry, even with the win last year against the Bulldogs, carry quite the interest throughout the community? What's your hunch here?
It should carry some interest, more additionally to what would normally be for a home game at that time of year. I mean, it's been quite some time since the Power 5 program came to Bulldog Stadium. I believe it was 2015, Utah came to town. Since then, BYU has probably been the biggest opponent to come in from the non-conference schedule. So it kind of pairing not only that it's a Power 5 program, maybe not the biggest name, but it is a Power 5 program, and that usually draws a lot of interest around here. And I think the hype around last year's game where it was so exciting and so closely contended should have had some fuel to that fire. Ultimately, it'll probably come down to what the Bulldogs do the previous week to see if it gets over the hump. If the Bulldogs beat USC, I've got no doubt it's going to sell out against Minnesota the following week. But if the season starts off on a bad note, that could certainly change things in week two for fan attendance. But I would certainly look at Utah State as well. You never quite know until November how that one's going to pair up with how the Aggies look with the new head coach and all that. But right now, I mean, they won 11 games. Fresno State won 12. I mean, that's an exciting matchup. And that was one that fans should be ready for before the season. And even if one of the two teams doesn't quite pan out, it should still be one of the better home games.
And that is start of November. And as we were talking the other day, going through the schedule, at least the times that we were given, you've got about a month between that game and the conference title game. And it may be, as you said, the Aggies, or it may be Boise State. Fresno State just hopes it's the Bulldogs. That's all there is to it. If you talk to Jeff Tedford again, you're going to get that look like, you know what, I didn't want to talk to you about USC right now. We're certainly not talking to you about the schedule at the moment. So we all understand that. Jackson, another thing football-wise, on the board you're going through previews position by position, correct?
Yeah, we've been going through that throughout spring and kind of holding some of those interviews for now since we're in the couple-month period now where we don't really have direct access to the team. So we've got today up some interviews with the defensive tackles, which has been a pleasant surprise from the last 10 months or so. I mean, when we went into last season, it wasn't a very promising group, to be honest. You had Kevin Atkins, who had a couple starts, but other than that, a lot of unknown players, really, and they really stepped up across the board. Now the Bulldogs have four returners that basically have starting experience, and that might be the strength of one of the strongest parts of the team, that interior defensive line.
Well, I tell you what, anybody has a chance to read, please do so, because it is, like you said, a good chance to get caught up on a lot of stuff going on at what, Jackson, how do you refer to this time of year? Because we are done with spring football. Some schools are not. You're well aware of that. It's also still semester time, so you don't have a lot of the guys out there for the voluntary workout. So how do you designate this time? Is this the true down period? Well, where academics, without question. By the way, our good buddy Steve Malanka just emailed in and said that what he saw through a tweet was that USC has the game listed as noon at the Coliseum. Now, I find that interesting, Jackson, because 12:30 usually means ABC. Noon is extraordinarily early for, say, the Pac-12 network. So I'm wondering where this game, if it is indeed noon, where this game would sit network-wise at noon. Fox rarely starts games at that time. You only see a lineup like this on Pac-12, for instance, if they've got a triple header or what have you. Are you surprised at all if that 12 p.m. holds? And I'm not saying, Steve, it won't. I'm just saying it's the first time I've seen it. Are you surprised at all about that?
I would be a bit surprised, Tony. I was thinking more of the lines of what happened last year with Fresno State and UCLA, where, I mean, that's still an interesting matchup regionally, but you don't have the power program in that matchup is not quite at the stature that it usually is, and that's kind of the case with USC coming off a 5-1 season. It's still going to be a big interest team, of course, and the game against Fresno State is going to be an interesting one as well. But it seemed like on a national television relevancy scope that it would be more in the type of an evening game, especially in the opening week when you have a lot of teams playing FCS programs, and you can kind of slot that one in there as one of the better ones on the West Coast.
Well, again, that is for USC an unusual time, but I guess not an unheard-of time. I'm just a little bit surprised. 12:30, Jackson, would have opened my eyes big, because 12:30 would have told me that you were looking at the network going after that game. And we know that Fresno State last year, certainly worthy of attention the last 2 years at 22 victories, but we're also aware that most of the time, as you were just referencing, it's really the talent of the Trojans, the productivity of the Trojans in regard, right, to their wins from the year before that governs this whole thing. We were talking that the only game they had listed for sure, for a certainty, for SC's schedule, everything is TBD except for the game at South Bend because, again, when Notre Dame and SC play, it's always sometime in October, the odd years in South Bend, and toward the end of the year, usually the last game or just prior to it, in December or late November here. Everything else is still up in the air, and as I look at the SC website, that is still up in the air. But, Steve, if that tweet is on the money, then Jackson, would a noon start be better for the fan base here if that is indeed the case?
Well, it is if you're looking to get back the same day, that's for sure. You know, if it's a 7 o'clock kickoff or 7:30 and you're there at the stadium till 11:30 or midnight even perhaps trying to get out of traffic and all that, I mean, that's a tough trip to make back home. But a noon kickoff is one where you can maybe wake up early enough that day or go up the day before and then get home that same night. So that would be a nice benefit if it is an earlier game.
We'll see. Again, I appreciate the information, Steve. If you look at the SC website, still one game and one game only for USC, the one in October at South Bend, which is a 4:30 start. NBC wants it prime time. That's the only one that's listed on the schedule as we talk right now. All right, Jackson, back to the original question I had for you. This time of the year, what do you guys do when you don't have the guys out there? They're busy trying to wrap up a semester. Is it, like you said, fall back on the prepared stuff that you've done already?
Well, the one part about this part of the year that makes things a little more interesting is that it's the spring evaluation time for football. So the Fresno State coaching staff is out there visiting recruits, you know, seeing them work out and practice during spring ball for the high schools. They're up and down the state, and you see a lot of scholarship offers go out at this time. So really, this type of period, while the Bulldogs aren't doing a whole lot with the team, it's a big part of recruiting, and we've seen with the early signing period and with Coach Tedford's tactics that the recruiting schedule has kind of gotten earlier and earlier the past couple of years. The Bulldogs have managed to get a handful of commits between June and August, and a lot of those commits are spurred by the offers that they get around this time of year. And even this weekend, I'll be over in the Bay Area for the opening regional. That's where they have the elite prospects from California, mostly Northern and Central California. They come from Hawaii, Washington, Utah. And that's an event that really showcases the type of recruits that Fresno State's going to go after and kind of separates some guys that may be those top-tier recruits or might fall to the Mountain West.
And by no means am I saying you weren't going to be busy. I was talking about just the guys on campus right now. The rest of that stuff, you're absolutely correct. I was just saying for the guys that are already on campus, not a lot you can do unless you want to try to interrupt their finals preparation, Jackson, which would be entirely up to you. All right, before I let you go, appreciate the time as always. Want to touch upon basketball a little bit here. First with Robinson, the 24/7 final rankings show him in pretty good shape, right?
Yeah, 24/7 Sports, they use their namesake and make a top 247 ranking of recruits each year, and he's in it. He's in the 200 range, but it's that top-tier group of recruits across the country, and it's a big deal for Fresno State to get someone in that group. Mountain West only had three or four guys total that are going to be coming into the conference this year that made that cut, so it's certainly not anything to overlook. Especially when you have schools like Arizona and Duke that are getting four or five of those guys themselves. So by the time the Fresno States are recruiting, there's not a whole lot of them to go around left. Orlando Robinson is going to be we have him listed as a center, but it looks like he may be an inside-outside kind of guy that can even stretch to the wing. He's a post player, but stands at 6'9" and has the athleticism. So I don't think he's going to be stuck in one role or another, and he may be able to find his way into the rotation, whether it is as a low post guy or a four or maybe even a three, if he can evolve his game that far, that fast.
Well, he is in the fold, as you're referencing, and so it's just a matter of how he fits in. With Baker, it's a completely different story. It's a SoCal guy, somebody who was at Kentucky, opportunity there cut short not only by injury but the numbers games that you see with the big boys. And when you're talking about Kentucky, you're talking about as big a program as it gets in college basketball. But as I was talking with Andrew Martin yesterday, Jackson, the difference between, say, Edwards coming back home where he was going to go to Nevada, but then Musselman, of course, left for Arkansas, that was truly a return home, and it was, okay, I'm not going to Nevada, but I will play in a light conference, the Mountain West. So that was kind of a move that was completely understandable. With Baker, with so much competition from the rest of the Pac-12, what is your point of view about Fresno State's legit opportunity with Hudson's success in SoCal, recruiting-wise, to get Baker here directly now?
Yeah, Coach Hudson has surprised me in some of the recruits he's gotten early in this process. Orlando Robinson being one of them, as a Southern California guy. He really has, I mean, he obviously has those connections from coaching at San Diego State for so long, but it's another thing to sell your vision of your own program. And for him to do that so early at Fresno State has impressed me. He's been able to get guys that had Central Valley ties to come home, Chris Seeley and now Darrell Edwards. And so really, I mean, I think Baker's kind of an open case with the five schools he's visiting, but it wouldn't surprise me if Coach Hudson was able to land him. It's a situation where Fresno State has three seniors at the guard position next year, and a lot of playing time will clear up for him after he sits out for a year if he were to come to Fresno State. It's an area in the Mountain West where, you know, it's not the strongest conference right now, but if you get a good team together and you're in that top two or three, you can get into the NCAA tournament, make a run, and get some publicity. And it looks like Coach Hutt is positioning Fresno State to be that kind of team, the team that San Diego State was for so long, the team that Nevada was for the last few years. And I think Coach Hudson also just his relationship with Baker going back to San Diego State, someone that he was trying to recruit there, all those factors make Fresno State a realistic option if he decides the Central Valley is someplace he wants to be.
Any idea when a decision might be made? I know it's not particularly pressing this second, but and it's going to be a sit-out year regardless, but any idea where we stand in regard to Baker making a decision here?
That sounds like Fresno State's one of the first visits, so it'll probably be a while. Usually when a recruit schedules in the five visits, they usually take them all. We do see times where recruits get their first visit and commit on the spot, but it sounds like he's got his long-term schedule kind of lined out, so it may be a few weeks before we get a final verdict from him.
All right, good enough. And then as I let you go, again, barkboard.com, pick up an insider sub. Want to ask you quickly about the Batesol situation. You know well that it appeared there was going to be an extension for Bates, and then you had Robertello no longer as the AD. Now are we right back with this team having a good year at this point to the extension being front and center, Jackson? What's your info on this thing?
Yeah, it's been kind of a perfect storm, or not storm, not the right word, but it's just the right lineup since last year on this current contract, and the team's doing very well. It seems like a pretty plausible move for them to move forward with Coach Batesol if they can continue to replicate what they did this year. Now, the past 6 years before that was pretty average, but if this year they can make some noise in the postseason, I don't think it would make sense to split off at that point.
Well, they have senior weekend coming up with San Diego State this weekend, then off to UNLV, and then back to Reno, where they just had a terrific three-game set. Off to Reno over Memorial Day weekend to contest with three other teams for that auto bid to the NC2As. It's been a while, like you said, 2012, one win only there, and then 2011, probably the last time where we really felt like this team had a legitimate chance to make a great run, but it was cut short by some really great pitching against Fresno State down in UCLA. We'll see what happens. Paul will have all the broadcasts for you this weekend. Jackson, appreciate it, my friend. Have a great weekend, and we will probably commence Thursday of next week because, and this will come as no surprise to you, the Giants have your time slot next week. There's a stunner, right? But, hey, you know what? They're starting to get real hot now. Mac Williamson getting the homer yesterday. He had three in Sacramento before they called him up. I'm figuring the Giants are going on 10, 15-game winning streak, so you're just going to have to deal with it, all right? Stop laughing. That's not nice. Only one of us laughing at a time about that. All right, Jackson, listen, appreciate it, my friend. I'll talk to you later. Take care.
You too. Thank you.
All right, guys, Jackson Moore, BarkBroad.com. We'll take a break. Come back with CG. Little transition work leading to his show. And then the aforementioned Giants, 5 o'clock today, with pre-5:40 first pitch from Coors and over on 790. Early start for the Sharks. Game 7 at SAP, 5:30, the pre, 6 o'clock. They'll drop the puck. We'll see if the Sharks can find their way to the conference final. This, of course, is the Bulldog Hour on your official home for Fresno State Athletics, 50,000 watt, 940 ESPN. Everybody, welcome back. It's about 2:34 here until 3 o'clock. CG will take over, bring you to 5 o'clock. Then the Giants will get started, 5:40 first pitch. Over on our sister station, the new 790, Game 7, the Sharks and the Avalanche from SAP. Early start, they'll drop the puck at 6 o'clock on our air with Dan Rusinowski. Also, if you have a chance to watch the game, you're not going to the game, but you have a chance to watch it on TV, NBC Sports Network will have that for you. We'll see how it plays out. The Blues winning last night. We know other side of the bracket in the East, the surprising Hurricanes and the Bruins. So the Sharks hope to fill out the dance card here against the Blues, who won in OT last night. And we've talked about the Stanley Cup playoffs many times. There's nothing better than overtime in a Game 7, and that's what we saw last night. May see it tonight again. Right now, let's bring Christopher up. We'll go over a few of your emails at tdead1@att.net. CG, how you doing?
I'm doing great, but you're right about the Hurricanes. I said early in the Stanley Cup playoffs that the Hurricanes just had that look about them like they were, you know, the team that's on the run, you know, the team that we see going into the NCAA playoffs in basketball that you may not have heard a lot about during the course of the year, but they just get on that kind of run. The Hurricanes have had that kind of run, and they've had that vibe this year, you know, getting called a bunch of jerks by Don Cherry, right, because they have those great post-game celebrations. I think what they've done to hockey this year in the post-game when they win, I think it's been great. I think it's been great to see that kind of charisma, what have you. They're not showing anybody up because it's after the game. There's nobody else on the ice. So I've enjoyed watching them. Russ is going with Boston in that series. I'm going to keep going with Carolina.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. I'm going to just enjoy watching dispassionately, which means without a rooting interest. I want to see what happens. But I'm with you about the bunch of jerks. First of all, only Don Cherry.
Yeah.
Afterward, instead of being somewhat apologetic, because, like, as you were saying, they were very careful to be at home and, you know, do the bowling pin routine or whatever. Far less offensive than the stuff on a game winner, a walk-off, where you had an orchestrated routine at home plate right in front of the other club, right? The catcher is still standing there.
Yeah.
Okay. But I will say this about Don Cherry. He knows you never back up lest ye suffer severe tire damage, all right? He just goes straight ahead. The first thing he said when they started printing the T-shirts, well, I need a cut of that. That's the first thing he said, because they started bunch of jerks T-shirts in the Carolina area. We'll see. For the Sharks, I mentioned this before, I hope it works out. The last time they and the Warriors were this close together, it turned out bad for both in 2016.
That's true.
So we'll see.
Yep.
And that will lead to the first email from Perry. It's not really about hockey, but it is transferable from hockey to what you and I talked about on Monday. Perry said, isn't what happened at the end of regulation in Game 6 of the Sharks and the Avs exactly the type of thing that CG and I were talking about on Monday? The context in regard to the clock time and the import of the event governs in large measure whether or not an infraction of the rules is called. We were talking about the Kentucky Derby. We also talked about the NBA. Do you blow the whistle the same way in the last 30 seconds you do earlier in the game? This hockey game, the Sharks were down. It was actually 2:13 to go in the third period. They score the tying goal. Gabriel Landeskog, who actually ended up winning the thing in OT, clearly out of frustration, CG, at that point, cross-checked. Okay, there's no doubt about it. I was talking to Russ about it off-air after it happened. They did not call the penalty, because if they did, they would have handed the Sharks, who already had a 3-2 advantage, a power play which essentially would have ended regulation. In your view, was that the right and just thing to do? In other words, does the context take precedence here, saying, yeah, that could have been and maybe should have been a penalty earlier, but we just can't do that right now?
No, I think they screwed it up. I
set it up for you to say yes. It was a good idea, but
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. And you know what? Everybody has their own views on this. For me, like you, I've been watching hockey over 50 years, and it's the one part of the sport that makes me nuts, and it makes me nuts in every sport when you see something. If it's iffy, and I'll qualify it with this. If it's an iffy call, you know, a call that can go either way, I like when the referees say, you know what, we're going to let that go because it wasn't too bad. But that was such an obvious, egregious moment, a foul penalty. I mean, Landeskog just laid him out. How they can turn away and skate up ice and act like that wasn't a penalty is ridiculous. And this is coming from someone who's not a Sharks fan. I'm rooting for the Sharks to win, but I'm not. If the Sharks lose tonight, I'm not going to be heartbroken. It's going to be okay. I just think that in hockey, more than anything else, they go out of their way to swallow the whistle. And I believe, and I said this to you on Monday, that what happens is in the referees' or officials' zeal to let a game play out and let the players essentially dictate the outcome, they are also on the other side of that coin, Tony. They are doing just as much to dictate the outcome by not calling an obvious penalty. That was the problem that I had there. Listen, there's a lot of bumps and knocks. There's cross-check. There's elbows and so on. There's hooks that players get away with in the third period of a playoff game in overtime. I understand that. But that was a play, I just, right in front of everybody, I don't know how they don't call that. I think as much as you can say it was a good right. non-call, I think it also basically gave the Avs, it could have swung the whole series the Avs way, that one singular moment. And there's always moments like that in games. But in that game, in that moment, I think they should have made that call.
Well, I'll tell you this, and you and I are in lockstep about this. The unwillingness to call a penalty, and we see it on occasion, but it's very rare at this time of year with so much at stake late in the process, right, game 6 or 7, what have you. It does lead to organized mayhem on the ice because once players are aware the officials do not want to blow the whistle, then it's okay, let's see how far right. we can push this, right?
Yep.
Let's go ahead and board every chance we get. Let's go ahead and create penalty that we know they don't want to call because they don't want to decide it in an odd man advantage, and that is a real problem. But let's take it further, CG. Let's go to what happened in 2016 with the Warriors. You had Draymond Green committing a foul against Steven Adams that was beyond the pale, but the Warriors were down in that series and they didn't suspend him. But when you got to the championship round where they were up 3-1, then the suspension came because of what happened when LeBron stepped over him. Again, do you look at that and say that's a league being hypocritical, or do you say that's a league that was aware of the context? I mean, is it the same thing you're talking about here, or was that different?
I don't think it's different. I don't really think it's different. And I think it this kind of a situation ends up being which side of the fence do you fall on? And what happens, Tony, is and I think rightfully so, and I'm not a conspiracy guy, but it does start to lend a certain flavor to, well, the league didn't want such and such team to win, or the league wanted the series to go a little further. And I think leagues, whether it's the NBA or the NHL, Tony, I think they open themselves up to that kind of criticism and that kind of scrutiny when they lack that sort of that consistency of calls, where if it's going to be a call, if it's not going to be a call in one game, why are you making a call or a suspension in another game? And nobody's perfect. I understand that, but it gets to a point where you do start to wonder, okay, how much is the league coming down quietly with the referees, with the umpires, with the officials, and so on, wanting something to go a certain way?
And I think there's a legitimacy in saying it doesn't even have to be spoken. It is understood by the officials what the league wants, and maybe that in a subliminal sense affects them. I don't know. I just know that I'm with you, that sometimes if you go too far in one direction, the players are smart enough to know what they can or cannot get away with, and that can lead to the problems that really turns into, like I said, rollerball out there, as we talked a few weeks ago. All right, I want to get to Len's email here, because he said, Charles Barkley's certainly right when he says that many of the national TV and radio idiots, an idiot, that was Charles' word, okay, that's what he said, that the idiots overreact and overanalyze immediately after every NBA playoff game is concluded. What Charles was saying was, you know what, every game we get all this micro-analysis about this happened, that happened, this happened, that happened, that it's not applicable beyond that game. What Len said is what Barkley neglected to mention was that he, Barkley, is one of the primary overreacting, in quotes, idiots. Barkley has made outrageous statements. You and I have talked about the hot take, right?
Yeah.
But I am in agreement, CG. I always think about Dabney Coleman, you know, great character.
Yep.
Okay, he had a show back in the early 80s called Buffalo Bill.
Really good
and funny show that didn't last long enough on NBC. He was playing the local morning host on television. You see it all over the place. Everybody has their morning shows. And he was Buffalo Bill Bittinger. And he, in his mind, owned the city of Buffalo. But a new general manager comes in, played by the fine Martin Landau. We know from, geez, you name it, Crimes and Misdemeanors, Ed Wood. For me, Mission Impossible.
Mission Impossible,
right?
Yeah.
He comes in. And immediately there's a power struggle. And Dabney Coleman calls in Woody, his producer, his little bald-headed producer, and says, you know, Woody, here's the problem here. I'm Buffalo Bill. I own Buffalo. And he starts to delineate a million reasons why it's an ego issue, and that's why Landau feels insecure and wants to take Buffalo away from blah, 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 blah. Goes through all these reasons, right? And Woody goes, yeah, it's either that, Bill, or he found out you were sleeping with his wife. To which Dabney Coleman says, without missing a beat, you know, Woody, I think you're onto something. All right, I bring this up, CG, because isn't that what we see with this? We get all this analysis, and then somebody else says, you know what happened? Durant and Curry missed open shots. That's why the game ended. You know, I think you're onto something. Where do you fall in this? Are you a guy who wants to hear the minutia, or do you say it's a make-or-miss league, and sometimes you make them, and sometimes you miss them, and the rest of the analysis can go right out the window in the 24-hour necessity of the sports cycle?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, because I think there, you hit on a couple of different areas that are key to this. Number one, if we can go back to Len's original premise, I do think that there is a – I think Charles is right – that there is a tremendous amount of overreaction in sports. You've heard my program, and you and I have talked about it many times, Tony, that it's human nature. It's our proclivity, especially in what we do, to have a bit of overreaction. I try to go out of the way not to overreact. I know that I have, though. But I also think Len is right that for Charles to say that, he's being a little hypocritical because he is an overreactor. Now, to the other part of what you said, I tend to want a little bit of both. I want to get a little bit of analysis. I want to find out why these guys, when I'm listening to Kenny or to Charles or Shaq, and they are as good of analysts as there are out there, and I like Ernie as well, I want to hear what are they seeing in the Warriors' half-court offense that I'm not seeing that they can pick out and show us on an isolation shot, on a replay. What are we seeing in the transition game where guys aren't filling their lanes, whatever. I want to see that too. But at the same time, Tony, you know what? You're right. Sometimes it is just nothing more than, hey, you know what? He missed that three that would have tied or won the game. Sometimes it really is as simple as that. It's not as complicated as it needs to be. This is game five, and the previous four games, Steph Curry had 7, 3, 4, and 9 points. Then I want a more detailed analysis. What are they seeing as former players that can lend itself to why Curry's struggling? But beyond that, see, I think it's a little – I like a little bit of both, Tony.
Well, hey, look, I agree with you. There are times – here's my issue with it. And you and I have talked about the hot take, and I am bothered by the hot take because the risk-reward, and I'm very sympathetic in the national level, the necessity to feed the monster all the time. It happens in straight news between MSNBC and Fox News and CNN. It happens every single day, right? So it happens in sports between ESPN, Fox, CBS Sports Network, you name it. The necessity to feed this beast all right. the time is there. So if you don't have a hot take, then maybe you're going to find yourself without a paycheck, too. And don't think for 1 minute you don't have producers egging your air talent on. You and I both know that. But I will say this, in the way of couching it, because as I mentioned to you before, go back to Namath, right, in Super Bowl III, we're going to win, I guarantee it. And afterward, many years after, so how'd you know, Joe? I didn't know, but we were 17-point underdogs, and if we lost, nobody was going to be surprised. But we win, I'm suddenly a genius. That's the upside of the hot take. Nobody remembers, or not many people remember when you're wrong. I told you Lou Holtz made the comment before 1 year when they're making all their predictions for studio shows, and he said, why don't we replay this back in December and see how wrong we were? There's no fun in doing that, is there?
Right.
But I will say this. When you start to go to cause and effect rather than what it is, as you're referencing, that kept the game close. See, to me, if you couch it properly, if you say the following happened, that's the reason this game came down to one possession, then I'm right with you. But if you're going to take that final possession and say this, this, and that, and what you saw was a wide-open look from a guy who's capable of making it, that to me is reaching for something, which was, to me, obvious. A guy just missed a shot. If you want to talk about what led up to getting there, fair enough. But don't tell me a highly makeable shot was missed because a guy did anything more than what human beings do, make mistakes once in a while.
Yeah,
that's sort of how I view it.
I completely agree with that. I think that's very well said, because I do think that sometimes, you watch somebody analyzing something over and over and over and over and over. And I remember Shaq one night on one of their Inside the NBA shows, after Charles went through this five-minute dissertation on a game, Shaq just goes, well, you know, Charles, they just scored one more point than they did.
There you go.
And that was it. That's what Shaq said. And it's like, and Kenny's like, he's right. And that was it. And it was that. Shaq was simply trying to show, you know, maybe tonight was just they scored one more point and they were 1 point better.
My late great father, the Obi-Wan, I told you, of the family, if you started that with him, he'd look at you and say, yep, and if the rabbit wouldn't have stopped the take, you know what, he would have won the race, which is his way of saying, don't hand me the what-ifs, I know what happened.
That's it.
Forget it, all right? It was one singular decision, that's it. The rest of your stuff is nuance that I have no use for.
That's right.
All right, one last email. It's from Mac, and I did want to get to this because Ohtani returns to the Angel lineup, but as a DH only, and this is something I'm really torn about because I've felt that the DH for years really bastardized the game of baseball because it changed all your pitching strategies. But what Mac said is, by Ohtani coming back as a DH because he can't throw yet, it's further proof the National League needs to keep up with the American League from a marketing standpoint, star players, by finally mercifully adding the DH. Are you at that point?
Yeah, and I think it's probably because I grew up in a town like you with both the American and National League.
Right.
And I grew up going to probably three times as many White Sox games as Cubs games, so I've always followed the American League more. And I'm not a hardliner. I like the DH. I enjoy it. But I also see the value of the double switches and the unique strategy that is in play with the National League. But ultimately, when I go to a baseball game, I'm watching to see guys strike out guys. I'm watching to see guys hit home runs. I'm watching to see a baseball game play out. When I'm sitting in the stands and I've got a beverage and a bratwurst, I'm not really trying to outthink the manager on what the strategy is going to be. No differently than if I'm at Levi's Stadium and I'm trying to figure what are they going to call on third and five here? Are they going to go deep? Are they going to do something over the middle? I just want to watch the thing play out and then go from there. So I do think it's beneficial to baseball when you're able to get Ohtani back as fast as it's not really that fast, but in a more expeditious manner. I think if he's playing up the road in Los Angeles with the Dodgers, I don't think he's back that. I mean, he might not be back yet. So I think for that reason alone, Tony, it's something that it would be nice to see the National League look at.
Yeah, you know, and I'm a guy who has really softened the stance on this for the reasons you just cited. I want to see the Stars play as long as possible. I don't want a team to be burdened by a guy who, for whatever the reason, cannot play defense, either not sufficiently or has some sort of physical ailment that prevents it, yet he's in the lineup in the American League. And I think it hurts the National League. I think it does hurt him marketing-wise, CG, in the last 30 seconds here. Would it level the playing field just as many star athletes, baseball-wise, ending up in the National League for the ends of their career as we see in the American League now?
I think so, Tony. I think so. I think you would see that. And I think over time, a lot more National League fans, I mean, there's going to be hardliners that will never go for it, but I think over time, when National League cities have their stars and they realize that suddenly those guys can be around two or three or four more years, five more years maybe, I think fans would go for it in the long run.
Yeah, and as soon as we change to three balls, two strikes, you watch the rest of the changes that are going to flow. Just kidding. Our seven innings is what I meant. CG, have a great one, my friend.
Thanks.
I'll talk to you on Friday.
All right.
Care. All right, guys. We'll take a break. Get you ready for CG after this on 50,000 Watt 940 ESPN.